With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
The new discovery for me was that the whole kind of dimension or process that came before the making, all the decision making, the, you know, the working something out, the real creative process.
Hi everyone, I'm Amy Devers and this is Clever. Today I'm talking to famed industrial designer Konstantin Gurchitch. Born in 1965, he grew up in Germany during the 70s, then headed to England where he trained in cabinet making at the John Makepeace School for Craftsmen and Wood, before studying design at the Royal College of Art. He started his design studio in 1991, and since then has designed several iconic and enduring pieces with noteworthy clients like Floss, Magis, Muji, Vitra, and many others. He's won too many international design awards to list here, and his work is in the permanent collections of New York MoMA and the Pompidou in Paris, among others. I'm a big fan of his work, so I was particularly excited to learn that he also grew up appreciating punk rock. Here's Konstantin.
My name is Konstantin Gurchitch. I'm based in Berlin, where I live and work. A designer running my own studio since more than 25 years. I became a designer because I love things and I love understanding how things work. And that led me to actually designing, making these things. And that's how I started. And that's what I'm still more or less doing today, even though many things have changed.
Yeah, the world keeps
changing. But yes, but
well, the problem is you keep designing the world. So we always like to go back to the very beginning to help us get a sense of what your beginnings were like and how you became who you are. So can you tell me about your hometown where you grew up, what your family dynamic was like, and kind of paint the picture of your childhood for us?
So I'm the second child of two. I have a 1 year older sister. We grew up in Germany. My mother German and my father from ex Yugoslavia, the Serbian part. And we grew up in different cities in Germany, West Germany, that is. I was born in Munich, but raised mainly in a city called Wuppertal, which is not very well known, but it's a very industrial city. It kind of, the industry is a textile industry and chemical industry and textile industry. In Germany, people joke about Wuppertal being a rather ugly city, which is not true. When you come from there, it's a city that is very lovable. You can find a beauty in the ugliness and certainly the beauties in the people that live there. So that's where I grew up. This is really the center of Germany. In the I was born in 65, so I grew up in the 70s. As a kid or a teenager, those were the years of still punk rock that I listened to and that informed these kind of very important years, teenage years. I wanted to go to
what
England.
What kind of punk rock were you listening to? Like international or very German?
No, actually international, but there was a very vibrant scene in Germany and quite in Wuppertal, in fact, and Cologne, which is nearby, Düsseldorf. Yeah, so there were some German bands at the time, Fehlfarben being one of them. that I liked and listened to, and they came from Wuppertal, but it was a lot of the British bands at the time. American punk rock I discovered much later, but also good.
That's a very important clue, I think, to your design aesthetic, but we'll get there. In your adolescent years, is punk rock how you were expressing yourself? And were you playing instruments, or were you just feeling like you needed to push against the establishment in some way?
So I don't play an instrument, and therefore I was never part of a band or that scene. What I like about punk rock was not even so much the, you know, being against the establishment, but a form of expression. And that is very direct, no compromise, straight to the point, short, loud, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make the kind of direct connections between that and what has become my work. Mm-hmm. But I still think that, you know, simplicity is something that really goes, you know, through my work as a red thread. And simplicity, directness, being radical, meaning really going to the roots of things, that was probably something that I picked up listening to punk rock and liking that scene and this culture and form of expression at the time.
And were you dressing the part and consuming the social elements of the punk rock scene as well?
Not to an extreme. So there are no photographs of me being a total head to toe punk rocker, but of course there were codes dress codes and hairstyle, and that I followed very closely, and I was, you know, I definitely had my style, and that was a conviction that, you know, I had to be a certain way. I was not the kind of the most colorful of punks.
I also am a devotee of punk rock, and I remember for me personally there was something very cathartic about that direct, honest expression that you're talking about, but also with that emotional catalyst to it. Like there was a willingness to not only say it directly and honestly, but to almost scream it, and to underscore its importance.
Yes, that movement was driven by a certain urgency. I mean, they needed and wanted to, like you say, go against the establishment and express that. From my upbringing, I was not in that position to have to fight against something, with that urgency. But I think that, you know, if we speak about how that has informed my work as a designer, I feel, you know, everything I do, I'm looking for an urgency in why I'm doing something, and also, you know, by choosing the means of doing it. I think it's urgency is actually something very positive. It makes you really want something, and that brings you to, you know, radical in the sense of really going to the core of things, trying to do something in a very essential way.
So from punk rock in your small town to studying woodworking at John Makepeace School for Craftsmen, how did you arrive at that decision?
Well, first of all, I finished school in Germany. We finished school by the age of, I think I was 19. And I didn't have to go to the army because I didn't have a German passport at that time. So I was not like my friends that had to either do social service or go to the army. I was free to do what I wanted after school. But what did I want to do? One thing I knew for sure, I didn't want to go back to school. I was so kind of relieved leaving school that would have been, you know, an impossible thought. So I definitely didn't want to study, that means. And I wanted to do something physical, practical, do something with my hands. My dream was building boats. And there's no explanation why, you know, I had that dream, because I never lived anywhere near water. I'm not a sailor. But from when I was a boy, I had a fascination with this thing that is swimming on water, a boat. Like maybe others, you know, they love planes. I love boats, and I wanted to build boats, and I was looking for an apprenticeship as a boat builder when I left school, and I couldn't find one. I traveled, you know, I was ready to move wherever somebody would offer me such a job, but at that time nobody did. It was quite frustrating for me. I just said that, you know, I was you know, leaving school, I was ready to do what I wanted to do, but the first experience was that I wasn't let to do what I wanted to do. I ended up working for a furniture restorer. That was the nearest possible, you know, job I could find. And I stayed there for a year, and it was really not what I wanted to do. But I have to say now, in retrospect, I learned an awful lot there. And it mm-hmm. probably was the kind of experience that made me discover furniture, which I hadn't really taken any notice of before. Mm-hmm. But restoring antique furniture brought me to furniture, and I'm more or less still doing furniture today. But what I knew was that I didn't want to repair or polish up old furniture, but make new furniture. So after that 1 year working mm-hmm. for the furniture restorer, I wanted to do a formal apprenticeship, learning the real craft of cabinet making. And it was through a friend of mine that I heard about John Makepeace, the John Makepeace School in the southwest of England. And that just sounded perfect for me, because England was, you know, now coming back to punk rock and all of, you know, that time, I, you know, England was the a country that I had traveled to before, and I loved. Mm-hmm. And so it sounded great going to England, to, you know, for this apprenticeship. Obviously, it wasn't London or any big city, but it was really in the countryside, in 3.5 hours away from London. And I found myself in a very small community of people working in these workshops. When I decided to go there, I wasn't aware what I was letting myself into, but it was, again, a discovery of something that would change my life, you know, in a very positive way, or in a way that I'm really grateful for. John Makepeace is a master craftsman in the tradition of the arts and crafts movement in England, mm-hmm. A personality in craft that in Germany we don't have this. In Germany, craftsmanship has become something very academic in a way, and very formal. In England, it's still connected to real personalities, people like John Makepeace that are almost artists. They are individuals mm-hmm. that have developed their craft, but in a very individual way, and obviously in a very creative way. And that became a role model, showing me just, on the one hand, of course, there was the education of, you know, skills, learning the skills. But then what you do with that skills is up to you. You decide
yes.
how you apply these skills. And it was, I think, at that time in these, this was a 2-year apprenticeship. We didn't really ever speak about design, but I feel that it was all about design. Or later on, I realized it was all about design, because design is, you know, asking questions about what it is you want to do, and how, and with what kind of resources and means, and. Mm-hmm.
Asking questions about the utility and the purpose and the
utility,
life cycle.
The purpose, the life cycle. Of course, it's also about, you know, design in the sense of giving form to something. But it came from that. That was a consequence of so many other questions and that kind of a whole process leading to something that has a particular form. I really enjoyed that. And I decided then that I want to do more of this planning, developing ideas, rather than the making. I enjoyed the making very much. That's why I went there. Mm-hmm. But the new discovery for me was that the whole kind of dimension or process that came before the making, all the decision making, the, you know, the working something out, the real creative process. And I decided to I wanted to go and study design. And since I was already in England, I was the natural next step was applying to the Royal College of Art, a postgraduate course in London.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Support for Clever comes from Wix Studio. Instead of reading you another, let's be honest, boring ad script, Wix Studio just sent me this wild-looking Alice in Wonderland-themed website to scroll through and tell you about. So, whoa. This is not the web I'm used to. There's something called mouse parallax, which makes it feel like you can go deeper into the screen. And as I scroll down, it's like I'm falling down the rabbit hole. And things are moving in depth and perspective. Even my cursor has morphed into a glowing little orb. There are all these no-code animations that make this place feel organic and alive. And Alice is wearing some pretty cool shoes, by the way. Okay, I know I'm mixing up my narratives now, but we are definitely not in Kansas anymore. Your turn to go down the rabbit hole. Build your next web project on Wix Studio, the platform for agencies and enterprises. Did you find that your 2 years at the John Makepeace School for Craftsmen also unlocked a connection between your brain and your hands in a certain way that also brought it back to the thinking that happens before anything even gets built, which is the design process?
Yeah.
And then, of course, it led you to Royal College of Art. But do you feel like your time there also helped you establish a sort of understanding of materiality in a way that served you in your design school?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, learning a craft, and that could be any craft, whether it's woodwork or metalwork or become a car mechanic. I think learning a craft is learning something from the ground up, and and learning something by doing and by understanding the logic of things. And what I know today, it has helped me. It is still helping me to adapt to all other materials, techniques, machinery, tools. Understanding that whole process of what it means to produce something, and that could even on an industrial scale or in the kind of on the small scale one-off or prototype making or batch production. And this really is an understanding I got from these 2 years at the John Makepeace School. Mm-hmm. And it's more than that. For me, those 2 years were the most important in my education. I feel my growing up from being, you know, a teenager, a kid, not really knowing what I wanted to do, to becoming more mature in my understanding of my own life, what I wanted to do, and how I could actually achieve that. And it really installed in me an attitude of mind, and that is an attitude of mind that I started to understand what work means, because I in my school life, I never understood what that really meant. And it was, you know, part of my problem in school that nobody taught me how to work properly. It's a gift to, you know, to understand that and actually enjoy that. And it kind of makes so many things more easy and clear and, like I said, enjoyable.
Yeah, it sounds like you really sort of opened up to your own sense of personal agency.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2 years is a very short time, but because it was such a small community of people and all quite like-minded in the sense everybody was kind of came there because of the work, because of the quality of work, and we were all kind of in our own way focused something. And then the experience at the Royal College was kind of, because the Royal College, in a way, the Royal College is a myth, and it's to me it sounded like the next step up, even better than John Makepeace. And I'd say it was then rather disappointing. The Royal College of Art was at that time not a good school.
What time are we talking about?
This is the early 90s. It was a great place. And I think that's what saved me. It was, for me, then it was great to be in London, and at the Royal College, you know, there were so many other great people, other students, also interesting teachers coming, passing through London and giving lectures or guest tutorials and so on. That's what was great about the Royal College. And they had a fantastic library. I think I spent probably half my time at the Royal College sitting in the library and discovering and kind of making up for my lack of knowledge in design and just studying design through books. But in terms of the teaching, really, and probably also in terms of what did I actually achieve there, what did I make, I think it was nothing. It wasn't very special. It wasn't very productive. But then, in a way, that almost sparked this, and now I'm going to say, urgency for me to get out and kind of find that energy again that I had leaving John Makepeace, and this kind of also, if you want, a form of confidence that, you know, I about my own work and my own way of doing the work.
No, this totally makes sense, because I sort of found a sense of my own agency and community that really seemed to parallel what I responded to in the punk rock movement when I found a small community of craftspeople who were making furniture. And there was a tremendous power in, I mean, obviously it was at a critical time for you because you were going from being a teenager to an adult, and that's a very formative time. But to be able to do that with a community, a small community of people who are driven and opening up in the same way, and you're accessing power you didn't have before, both to manipulate materials, but to think about, you know, how you can shape your own life and how the world is built. And then it sounds like at Royal College of Art, it galvanized the idea that you have to be proactive about your own education and about finding that thread of urgency or importance that's going to keep you energized and moving through.
Exactly. And I think that you put it perfectly, because I think really the main thing I got out of the Royal College was the you know, understanding that, you know, it's up to me. Nobody will, you know, there's nobody, you know, to hold my hand. In a way, I didn't want that anyway. But it was up to me to make things happen and to take things in my own responsibility. To be fair, there were good people at the Royal College. Jasper Morrison was there as a teacher. He was an ex-graduate from the Royal College and still a very young designer at that time. And he came into the Royal College. He was one of my teachers, and I learned so much from him. Also, Vico Magistretti, one of the great Italian masters, who, I guess it was those two that became real role models, very different. One, yes. You know, being probably in his 70s and, you know, someone who had built his career in very different circumstances. And the other one, I think Jasper is 6-7 years older than I am. And, you know, someone who has just set up his own studio and making his way. And so I had these a very close experience, very personal experience of these two perspectives. And that really encouraged me, helped me through the 2 years at the Royal College and encouraged me in setting up my own practice straight after leaving.
That's what I was curious about. What did you do after graduation? Did you go straight into...
For a short while, I worked for Jasper Morrison. That was because he had a job and he needed some help, and it was good for me to do that. But then I set up my own office, and that, now I'm talking about 1991 is kind of a phone, a fax machine, a drawing mm-hmm. board, a tiny, tiny little computer, a kind of a Macintosh Classic, which is a typewriter and not for
tracing
drawing. Tracing paper, and so on. It was easy, in a way, to set up your own office. And life was kind of, I'd say, rather simple. And with very little, you could get by. And that was my calculation. I had this kind of number of, now there's euros. At the time, it was still a different currency, a German currency. With just 1,000 Deutschmark, which is something like 500 euros, I could live a whole month. So I had to earn 500 euros a month to get by. And that made it fairly easy. People sometimes ask me just, you know, how, you know, courageous that is to set up your own thing, and must have been difficult. I think at the beginning was not difficult. It became difficult just probably 4 or 5 years later, when, you know, then you start to be more established, or projects become more difficult, you have more responsibilities, everything
larger
becomes
scale. More, yes, so a quick logistic question. Since you studied in England and you moved back to Munich, right? You started your studio.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you feel a disconnect from, let's say, the creative context and the professional context and community that you'd established in school? And how did you start to get clients? And how did you feel like you had enough business acumen to cover all the entrepreneurial aspects of running your studio?
Well, I have to cut this story very short, but it wasn't my choice to go back to Germany. I wanted to stay in England, but I had mentioned before that at the time I didn't have a German passport. The fact is I did not have a passport of the European Community at the time, which meant that I wasn't allowed to stay in the UK.
Oh,
That's what made me go back to Germany. And at the time, the UK was going straight into a deep recession. So all my friends, colleagues from college, they all had a hard time finding jobs. And that probably made it a little easy for me to pack my things, go back to Germany, mm-hmm. where things were kind of comparatively good economically. And of course I had, you know, connections. I had a network of people I knew in Germany. It was, in fact, a German friend from London had just moved back to Munich. He was an architect. He set up his office. I rented a desk inside his office. That was my first office.
So
again, yeah, perfect. And like I said, quite easy. And just, I didn't have a business plan. I didn't have a great strategy. I just wanted to do my own thing. And it was fine to do that on a very small scale. And that small scale would kind of mean that I stayed very independent, and there was no pressure to do project that I don't want to do. It's just so different today, I guess, for anyone who's leaving college today. The kind of privilege back then, 30 years ago, was that, you know, life was quite simple. And that allowed me to do things, start, you know, with doing very, very small little steps. and learning by doing, because, you know, when you leave college and start your own thing, you have no idea.
Oh, yeah. Each project is a learning curve.
Each project is a learning curve. And what it actually means to run an office and to do business in kind of quotation marks. That was nobody had shown me. But I, you know, I had time to learn that in a kind of soft way. I'm quite grateful for that.
Yes, I can hear it in your voice that you're grateful for that. But it also is a different time now.
Yes.
Things happen at a different pace, and there are different pressures. But looking back over the 25 years that you've been doing this, there are a number of pretty prominent projects out there with your name on them. I wonder if you can talk about some of the projects or the pieces that have the most meaning to you personally, or even which ones that fostered your personal growth in the most impactful ways.
All of these projects are connected to people, because what I realized is that doing my work, I need a partner or client or producer or, you know, whatever. I could say I've been lucky, or I could say I've had a good kind of instinct for finding the right people at the right time, people that I could trust. And I had a lot of trust, and I wasn't kind of starting my business and feeling, you know, this is a scary world out there. I thought it was, you know, here I am. I want to do work, and I had trust in that, you know, out there, there were good people that could help me or enable projects. And one of the kind of really important people was a guy I met. Somebody introduced me to this guy who had a company producing plastic, everyday life plastic products. Waste bins, soap dishes, toothbrushes, drinking cups, little things. But they were very well designed, in the sense they were very simple, nice objects made of an interesting quality of plastic, polypropylene with the translucency that was something new or different at the time. This guy was producing in Italy and China on a really industrial scale. That was definitely my dream as a, you know, I called myself an industrial designer, you know, without any experience as an industrial designer, but that's where I wanted to be, working for industry. And so this man, Hans-Jörg Meyer-Eichen, opened that door for me because these projects were simple. He felt I could do that. I designed a waste paper bin in plastics after a year and a half being out on my own. And again, I would say it was rather simple, easy. It just took me into a new kind of sphere or onto another level of, it was super exciting, the fact that, you know, they would make a tool and, you know, make an investment into a tool. And then these things came out of a machine, you know, every whatever, 30 seconds. And they cost, they were really affordable. It was a nice product that I could relate to. It belonged to my life. And I designed it to go out there into the world. I think it gave me a lot of confidence that, you know, from my background as, you know, from woodworking and then doing projects at the Royal College that I was never really comfortable with, the typical student type projects, suddenly I had kind of arrived or landed in this real world of industrial design. And it wasn't all difficult. It was kind of easy or feasible, doable for me. And so that I think gave me a real push. I guess then what are the other stepping stones? I think the Mayday lamp for floss. Probably now we are in my fifth year running my own practice. I designed this lamp, which was a very, very personal product, I would say. Still today, I feel this is a lamp I really designed for myself. But it became successful and all these projects do something. They add a little bit of, I don't know, experience. But being young, what you really need is confidence in just feeling encouragement that you're doing the right thing. And
yeah, that goes such a long way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would say the waste paper bin that I was talking about was still a very, that's a very industrial product, everyday life product, not a product where you put a lot of personality into this thing. But the Mayday lamp, I think, had this element of, it was my story, this lamp, what I wanted it to be. And the fact that that actually made it, became a commercial success in the sense that other people would feel, oh yeah, I understand that lamp, and I know how to use it. I know what to do with it. I know where to put it. Because why I designed that lamp was not only my own personal scenario, but actually a lot of people had similar needs or use for such a lamp. And I think that was therefore quite nice. And that was an Italian company. Maybe I should add, Floss is an Italian lighting company. And all my heroes, designers that I looked up to, and the whole of my, when I said in the Royal College of Art, I kind of studied all the history of modern design. For me, the most important history of modern design, the one that I could relate to, it was all happened in Italy. So for me, being able to work with an Italian manufacturer was also a dream come true. And I guess then from there, it moved quite quickly. Then working for one Italian company, you become visible for other Italian companies and they call you and ask you to work with them and so on. And it's, I mentioned before that if the first years were very simple and easy, I'd say around that time it became more complicated. And of course, I made mistakes choosing maybe the wrong companies that I worked with. And I made mistakes, or I made also the odd bad experience and had to kind of reverse certain decisions. And but all of that was necessary, of course. You also learn from mistakes.
Yes, mistakes are important teachers.
Yeah.
Can you give me a sort of a snapshot of what your practice looks like today? Because, I mean, you're firmly established in the world of design, world renowned, we could call you. You have the luxury, I assume, of choosing the projects that have the most appeal to you. So what types of projects do you gravitate towards these days?
Well, first of all, I would say I have the luxury of choosing to stay small as a studio. I knew that this whole thing would only work for me if I stayed small. I could have grown over the years, but expanding would have meant that I end up not designing, but managing an office or people. I want to design things. That's why I'm a designer, and that's why I stayed small. And as a small office, and kind of, like you say, renowned, or with a certain, we have a certain name in the industry. Yes, I can choose projects, but also I have to choose projects. Because simply we cannot do more than our capacity allows. My studio is, there's five of us all together. That's myself, three designers and a studio kind of manager. This small team, we can only do a certain amount of projects, and that's why I have to be choosy about and selective about projects. Also, of course, it's a kind of privilege being able to pick just the ones that interest me most. Or as we are working with clients, a lot of my client relationships are very long term. I have quite a few companies that I work with for way over 10 years, and I feel we will probably be working for another 10 years as partners, and that allows me to say no to a lot of some of the companies that approach me.
And those long-term relationships are wonderful because you've already built the trust and established the shorthand communication, and
yes,
you really get to dive deeper, once you've gotten through that.
Exactly. It becomes a very personal relationship. You know each other. You know how the chemistry works, how the whole kind of logistics of it. And you trust each other because you've gone through, the ups and downs with every project. But it also means that, every next project kind of builds on what you've done before. It's not going back to square one, but you pick up on where you've kind of left it with the previous project, and it becomes its own story within the company. I think, again, the kind of, if you look at the history of design and the great masters and their most important projects, you will see that a lot of them, these good projects by the good people, they did them for the same clients because there was this close relationship, this close dialogue and intensity, and not real knowing each other. I think design is such a difficult discipline. It's not easy. We speak about how much fun it is and it's enjoyable and so on. Yes, it is, but it's also really hard work. It needs the right environment and the right conditions or circumstances, and of course the team. And that's what a long-term relationship with a client, what that provides.
I think that there is a through line also from the honesty, emotional urgency, and the sort of chaotic and disruptive elements of punk rock that show up in your design work. And I think that's really powerful. It's obviously not a direct interpretation, but there is an element of chaos and disruption and humor and urgency that you've been able to protect, I want to say, from getting distilled out of your projects. And that in itself, I think, is rebellious and disruptive, but also I think it's pretty badass, for lack of a more eloquent way of describing it. And I wonder if these relationships are part of how you're able to do that, or if you have just been uncompromising, or if you have anything to say about how you've been able to protect those elements of your design work from getting distilled out into sort of a market-driven consensus project.
Well, I think a bit of both. I'm uncompromising because I just know myself well enough to know that it doesn't work for me. If I start making compromises, I lose touch with what I'm doing. It's work which means so much to me because it's my passion, and my life begins to kind of slip out of my hands and mind and kind of so I need to, it's a self-discipline protecting this each project, as staying really close to me, and that means uncompromising, but true also that I can only do that because I have partners in these really good clients that I've been working with for a long time that have become friends. Some of them, they are definitely mentors in a way, because I've been learning from them and through them. They enable me to do things, and I feel that has helped. And I don't know, how do you find these people? It's, you have to bring the kind of trust into this relationship, mm-hmm. but also an instinct, or it's about, you know, listening to the kind of chemistry. I think most important for, you know, choosing projects, or, you know, deciding I'm going to do this project or not this or not, is a decision you make. It's about, you know, the people. I've said no to projects that were interesting, but I felt that, you know, the people involved, it wouldn't have worked for me. I find myself doing projects that, you know, I'm doing, don't get me wrong, if I say out of a favor for people, because some of these people, I love them so much that it's I enjoy it so much working with them. I do projects even that are not the most urgent. I have to admit that also. But in the long run, I always feel that's still the better way. Working with people you like, you enjoy working with, and then, you know, beyond work, spending time with, that's what matters most.
Mm-hmm. And being able to align on the goal and work together
toward it. Yes.
And cultivate a meaningful relationship in the process. That sounds like the meaning of life, Constantine. thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Before we let you go, do you have a project in the works that you can talk about that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
Now we are just 4 or 5 months away from the Milan Furniture Fair, which is still the most important event every year for showing new work for my practice. And 4 or 5 months away from that means we are really in the final stages of a handful of projects that are going to be launched there. The usual clients that are Magis and Planck, a Spanish company called Ketal. And then we are doing an exhibition that's going to open in Rome, in Italy, in February. It's an exhibition on curating and designing, an exhibition about architecture, a certain point of view about architecture. I was free to choose works from the archives of the Maxi Museum. Maxi is the Museum of Contemporary Art and Architecture in Rome, built by Zaha Hadid, famous for that. They have a collection, an architectural archive and collection, and I've been able to kind of go into that archive and choose and find a project. And I've came across 4 amazing architects. 3 of them I hadn't known, Italian architects from the 60s and 70s, that are kind of utopian architects, people that in their time, they kind of looked at the future in a very optimistic way, and really believed that the impossible was possible, and absolutely incredible to see what, you know, these visions and ideas were in terms of, I mean, in a formal way, but also in terms of scale, in terms of futuristic vision of what cities are becoming. And, you know, they were really working on grand scale projects. And I have to remind you, without computers, that was and really on the drawing board, but with the kind of, it's all about imagination, their ideas that they were able to bring to paper, into models, and some of these projects were even built. And I discovered some of these incredible projects in their archive, and we are designing a small exhibition, but very. It's going to be very interesting, and just the process of kind of curating this exhibition alone has taught me so many things, and again is now encouraging me to even, you know, here I am in 2020, and we have so many, you know, so many more tools and, in a way, opportunities today than they had, and let's use all of that for and be really, you know, forward looking and positive and imaginative. Maybe you can hear in my voice, I'm really enthusiastic about this project.
Yes.
And of course, being the not only curator but also designer of the exhibition, my exhibition design, the fact how the way in which we are displaying, presenting these projects had to be somehow adequate to what they had done. And just to give a little kind of hint to what this exhibition is going to be, I'm commissioning a digital artist, people that work for the film industry mainly, so-called matte painters. I'm commissioning one of those painters to produce a huge picture, like a billboard-size picture, a visualization of a utopian landscape, incorporating some of these built and unbuilt projects from these architects. So in the exhibition, in a way, we are, if only with a picture, we want to kind of realize something of what was their vision by means of a huge, a very, very kind of hyper-realistic picture, painting, rendering. It's going to be quite amazing, I think, and very exciting.
We will be sure to include links to that.
Yes, it will soon be announced, and the date is the 5th of February. That's when the exhibition starts, and at the Maxi Museum in Rome.
Well, congratulations on that, and we'll be excited to see all of your new furniture projects in Milan. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Amy. It's been lovely. It's been really nice talking to you. Thanks for listening and for making this conversation so easy.
Hey, thanks for listening. To see images of Constantine's work and read the show notes, click the link in the details of this episode on your podcast app, or go to cleverpodcast.com, where you can also sign up for Clever's newsletter. If you haven't already, subscribe to Clever on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would, please rate and review. It really does help a lot. We also love chatting with you on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Clever Podcast, and you can find me at Amy Devers. Clever is created and produced by me, Amy Devers, along with Jamie Derringer. Our production company is 2VDE Media, with editing by Rich Straffolino and music by L1011. Clever is proudly distributed by Design Milk.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.